Welcome everyone to the Education for Climate Talks. Today I'm very glad to have with me Frank Niepold. Hello, Frank.
Hello, it's so nice to be with you. This is a wonderful opportunity. A long time coming, actually. I've been wanting to do this. I just didn't know how.
Thank you. Thank you for that. As we can see in your background, you're working in the NOAA. So let me present you very briefly. You're American, you're working in the American, very famous, I should say, prestigious scientific organization, which is the NOAA, so basically the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. But you also co-chair in the U.S. Global Change Research Program, the Climate Engagement and Capacity Building Interagency Group. It's very long, but we understand that you work with the U.S. administration also on climate engagement with citizens, and it's about capacity building, something very interesting for us. And on the other side, you also work with the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, so the UNF3C. On there, you lead the U.S. National Communications Report chapter, and you lead it on education, engagement, training, and workforce development. Yep. So we get the picture. We understand that we are today having a very interesting conversation with someone very much indeed deeply involved in scientific education, and even more precisely, climate education. So Frank, you are really, again, we're very glad to listen to what you're going to share with us. And maybe, Frank, we can start from your journey, because it's a long journey now that you had into education for a sustainable development. So it will be very much interesting to understand this. And also, because you're working now in the NOAA, why the NOAA and the US government are interested in education for sustainable development. Please, the floor is yours.
Sure. So the reason why I said I am so excited to finally have this conversation is because for the very long time, you know, when the treaty, the United Nations Framework Treaty was established, Article 6 of the treaty was really about education, public awareness, and training were critical pieces of how we are going to advance, how humanity will respond to climate change. We've never really fully lived up to the power and potential of that article, but this conversation actually gives me hope that we actually might finally get there in 2024, even though the treaty was 1992. So it's been a long time coming. But, you know, so my journey is, it's an interesting one. Actually, a lot of times students and young professionals ask me this question, like, how did you get to be you? So I've thought about this a great deal. So, you know, I mean, I think the easiest way to get to the answer, in fact, is, you know, I knew education was important. I actually started off in fine arts. My first degree was in fine arts, and it was really about the relationship between human and natural systems. And then eventually I found that art wasn't the right tool. And so then I went and became a human ecologist with a focus on education. And then I was a teacher, and I started working at NASA on something called Mission to Planet Earth in 1994. And you know, I'm a very mission-oriented person. Always have been, always will be. And the Mission to Planet Earth was really a powerful mission, and I worked for it, but it was really more remote sensing and biological change and land cover change. But, you know, climate was emerging in the late 90s for me as there's something really important in this. And so as that went on, you know, I found myself wanting to really dedicate my work in education, in climate, in government, solely on this. And then an opportunity showed up at NOAA, which is an organization that I hadn't really thought about in this space because I was at NASA. And but I came to realize that NOAA is uniquely focused on the home planet in a way that all the federal agencies like National Science Foundation and EPA, Department of Energy, they kind of have a broader remit. They focus on lots of other things. So I had the unique and honor to start climate education for NOAA. And they knew that education was important. They knew climate was clearly important because it'd been in the bones of the organization, but education hadn't really been figured out. So in 2005, I joined the organization, and I come from formal education, K-12 education. But in this position, I had to learn every form of education that would be important to dealing with climate. There's so many forms and they're all important. Everyone will say to me, I partner with a ton of people worldwide and across the United States. And they're like, you know, in museums are really important. I'm like, yes. And, you know, K-12 is really important. Yes. And, you know, parks are really important, and conservation education and interpretive education and career and technical education. And my answer is always yes. But what's really important is the learning that goes through all these systems. And so I've had the distinct, you know, 18 years of learning of what does education for climate look like within a US context. But I don't think it is so unique to the United States that the principal intent of the original treaty was there were six parts. And the last one was collaborate internationally. And so we've never really fully gotten the deep collaboration potential out of the work that we're doing in the United States across so much work with the European Union and the deep work you're doing. But if we don't actually collaborate and share and learn from each other, then we really miss the opportunities for maximizing what that original treaty, whoever wrote that, whoever championed putting Article 6 in the original treaty, I mean, hallelujah. But I think what we do in that and with the spirit of international collaboration is really, I think, a very important area for us to focus on. We can talk about, you know, I write the national communications chapter on education and training. I've been doing it since 2006. I don't know if anybody's ever read all that work I put into writing that thing with a really wonderful team. It's a really good, important document, but is anybody looking? You know, it's like you write and then you hope. And, you know, no one's ever said, you know, wow, that was really, because they don't see my name there, so they don't know who to talk to. It's just the way the documents work. And two, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's an interesting bit of work that I don't think we've leveraged strongly enough. I've never looked at the European Union one. I've looked at the Egyptian one because I was working with Egypt, and I've looked at the Saudi Arabian one. I've looked at the Chilean one. I've looked at the Dominican Republic one, but I don't know what the actual European Union chapter says. So anyway, it's been a long journey, but I think what I've learned is, it's a really big task, and it's more important that education plays a critical role in how we address climate change. We can't address climate change successfully without every form of education fully employed, and our young people are screaming for it. Our adults are even asking for it. So let's get to it.
Thank you so much. So collaboration, learning, and by the way, we're learning with others and by others, so certainly we need to collaborate. I mean, what you're saying is really music to my ear, of course, because this is precisely what we're trying to do. As you rightly say, it's not always easy. And for us on the EU, as you know, education is on the member states. But we can still do things at European level, which is what we did with the Council recommendation. We had the talk prior to that registration to together explain to you this, which is where we try to invite member states also on the member state themselves to try to work together, converging towards common objectives. And obviously, education is absolutely key when it comes to our capacity to adapt to climate change. And you are saying, and this is something also which is important for us because we're a joint research center, so scientific department, is that, yeah, I think education is part of the job of any sort of scientist who has to disseminate, to share his knowledge, which means that there's always normally a bit of his time that should be dedicated to sharing, in particular with K-12 students, to my view. But now, could you please share with us maybe some specific initiatives you are doing so that we understand better the sort of things you're doing? Depending, of course, on your priorities, please.
Oof. There's a long answer there, but I'll try and be crisp and precise. So in the United Nations Framework Convention process on national communications, there's this whole process where other countries review those national communications. And so when the international community come and have a conversation with the United States about its contributions that it's reporting. One of the things I first say is that, like, you have to appreciate the United States is a very unique country. We're the third most populous country, the largest economy, and we cover 9 time zones, from Guam to Puerto Rico and the US Virgin Islands, from the Florida all the way up to Alaska. I mean, the geographic expanse, and we have 570 sovereign nations inside the United States, which are tribal nations, sovereign. There are nations. And so it puts the how we work. You know, we have 15,000 K-12 school districts, 15,000. And states have much more autonomy over education, which is more like the German model, federalized education, as the French model, right? The French model is much more national education. So for us, the France approach is actually California, just one state. And we have 50 of them plus 5 territories. So the reason I belabor the kind of the complexities of our social system is how we work is very, unfortunately, uneven. We have the intent that every young person should be knowledgeable, literate, skilled, empowered, have full agency on dealing with climate. But we don't, as a national government, have the authority to just mandate. That's not how it works. So we have to work with frameworks and initiatives at subnational coalitions and initiatives and networks, as opposed to, you know, policy. Our policy architecture is incredibly diverse, which right now, if you look across the United States, you see policies that are starting to merge in states and doing really interesting things that are very diverse, which is a healthy thing. And it's also, you know, it's a challenge. When we talk to young people, and I think one of the most interesting things that I think the European Union could learn from what we're doing right now, we're just getting there, is actually listen to your young people, actually talk to them and ask them, what do you want your education system to do for you? So we have this document, one initiative I'm working on right now called the Climate Literacy Guide. And in the process last year, we had a 21 listening sessions, and we had a strong number of listening sessions with young people. And I don't know why. I've been in education almost 9 years. Why we don't actually, when we build educational initiatives, processes, standards, textbooks, we actually don't engage the learner on what they would like to learn. We know from research that relevance and coherence are incredibly important to learning. And yet the learner, what would be relevant to them now, it's very different for them. The way they want to learn climate is different. I've talked to young people tons of times. And so we're trying to structure our learning frameworks around really what would resonate with our young people, that they want a much more action-oriented education. They want a much more comprehensive and coherent education, meaning it can't just be science. And so if we actually honor by what we're hearing, then, you know, our frameworks, our standards, our textbooks, our museum exhibits, our programs would align much more in an action, justice, and transdisciplinary approach. That's what they're asking for. So, you know, that climate literacy guide that I mentioned, I can share the link to the 2009 one, but I expect probably September we'll be releasing the updated version of that. And you know, it's been used internationally, and we actually built it to be a transformational document in the spirit of international collaboration. No other country's made something like this. And so we're actually looking at that. Now, another initiative we're working on is the skills. Now, a lot of that previous one I was talking about was much more about knowledge. What should you know? But then we also are hearing is, what should we be able to do? We know the skills for the 21st century are different. Well, let's be specific. And one of the things we found was, it's interesting, education for sustainable development, but there's the sustainable development goals. But one of the initiatives that's spinning off of the sustainable development goals is the inner development goals. It's European led. And the inner development goals, we looked at it as a transformational framework for the skills that are necessary for people to do sustainable development. And then we looked at it within a climate lens, because remember, there's a whole bunch of sustainable development goals. One of them, 13, is climate. 4 is education. So we looked at the intersection of 13 and 4, not inner development, but climate inner development. And we're working, you know, to move that initiative forward, because I think, you know, when you're talking about so many people and so much diverse systems, social systems, frameworks are actually really powerful tools. Partnerships and networks are really powerful tools. Coalitions are really powerful tools. So, and then I guess one of the other ones I'd share is, you know, there's so many actors working in this space. I imagine across the European Union, every time you go into a country or a community and you start digging into this work, you find non-governmental organizations, museums, zoos, aquarias, K-12 systems, universities, all, you know, that are actively working on climate. But what's also true is that you tend to not work together, not because they don't want to. In fact, they are very naturally collaborative. Is that there isn't something that is inviting them into a framework, a network to work together. So, you know, I think this initiative has some of that work in it, but I think the more we understand network theory and network analysis and network architectures, it actually is an initiative that we need to build. We've been building the climate energy, the climate literacy and energy awareness network since 2008. We've had weekly meetings since 2008. Think about that, weekly meetings since 2008. That means there's so much to talk about, so many actors, so much interesting that, you know, I think that, you know, what we've long looked after under the United Nations framework side is, why isn't there a strong, robust climate education international network? There's nothing that we're doing that sits uniquely in our own community context. Learning is learning. People are people. There are differences in cultures, and that's important, but there's a lot of sharing opportunity that we just aren't, you know, fully maximizing yet. So, you know, I'm always game for building networks and collaborations. That's why when you asked me to join you in today, the answer is going to be absolutely yes, because until we get this really going, we haven't fully fulfilled the possibility of international collaboration.
Thank you, Frank. And we want to go beyond the network in order for the people who are working together to precisely deliver together. What you're describing is super interesting and very close in a way to what's happening in the EU. So you focus very much on the need for collaboration, meaning that maybe there's not enough collaboration. The states are maybe not also comparing or benchmarking enough what's happening in the their neighborhood. You focus very much on action-oriented education, meaning that it's not the case enough. And the young people are telling you, of course, that they want that to be to happen because they really want to develop their skills. Yeah. So maybe experiential learning and project-based learning has got to be strengthened. So hence my question to end that interview. For that, of course, people have got to change. And changing is never a very easy process. So what are the sort of challenges you're facing in trying to invite people for that change? And of course, the way how you meet these challenges, please.
Sure. So, wow, challenges. So many. I mean, the system complexities are really challenging. I mean, I was just talking with some partners yesterday across federal families about how we would do this. And, you know, the network architectures, the coordinators, the data scientists, the platforms, the communicators, we don't invest the professional skills to stably do that work. Because, you know, our ability, you know, we kind of just haphazardly found each other. We should have known about each other for a much longer time, much sooner. So the systems and we just don't fund those. I know what this looks like now, and it frustrates me to no end that we cannot get the funding for the people to build the relationships. I know what a network builder is. I know what a community practice builder is. I know what a strategic, you know, but the asking somebody who's a doer in a project to do this too is historically what we do. So I'm a coordinator. I have the unique position to coordinate the United States on climate, which is an interesting problem. But I mean, in order for that to really be serious, you would need a much larger team with diverse expertise. And those expertise are different with tools and contracts that are enable you to really, I mean, you need digital platforms that are robust. I know what they look like. I cannot find the money to do this, which gets us to our second challenge. The investments in the potential of what we are talking about is so much greater than the actual investment. So much untappedness, if that's a word. You know, we are not fully optimizing what we are talking about in this conversation because we don't have the investments to actually bring it to. I know what that looks like as well, because in 2010, Congress told NASA, the National Science Foundation, and NOAA to invest in climate education. And we over $200 million over for those years, and it was spectacular. And we did amazing work, and then it stopped. And so it came up and down. And some of the legacies and ripples of all that work are still moving through this field, but they're struggling because they just can't find the funding to do the next smart bit of work, what in any form of education they're coming from. So it's the funding is challenging. And then, you know, education has this focus on learning and stop. And what our young people are saying is learning for action. So it's funny, the name you have, Education for Climate, in a US context, we would put another word at the end of that name, Education for Climate Action, right? So like that action orientation is just, you know, it's challenging though, because I'm a former earth science teacher. And earth science teachers, I mean, my students used to joke with my class was the 10 ways the world comes to an end. And I'm like, that feels terrible. It feels terrible. And I'm like, I took that to heart. And, you know, a lot of what I do now is still motivated by, oh, that's what's happening inside your head in your experience in this, is that this is all about the end. And I'm like, no, this is about using that information on how to create more thriving, sustainable futures, not to just understand the way it ends. And so, but that is pedagogically and philosophically challenging for disciplinary education. So we have to go to transdisciplinary education. I'm asking for a very big change. That's a big barrier. But until teachers finally get comfortable with transdisciplinary education, great education, then, you know, that's going to be another one. And I think the last one is a challenge. Right, so there's two more. You know, collaboration only happens if we are connected to each other. It gets us back to that system thing. And so if you don't know about each other, and I've seen it over and over and over again, the United States has so much going on right now because of the historic funding from the three major climate bills, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, the Inflation Reduction Act, and the CHIPS and Science Act. So much work is going on that it's like fire hose with another fire hose with another fire hose with a fire hydrant all pointing, and so much water is flying right now. But it's hard to see what the patterns and coherence and opportunities are, which is a good problem, but it's still a problem. And the last one is, you know, we're asking for society to change agriculture, transportation, energy production, housing, land use, food systems, keep on going, transportation, international transportation, flights, ships. We're asking to change all of that in order to deal with climate change, where we live, how we move around the world. So the natural resistance to all of that change is a real challenge. But the good news is that, you know, our current economy will actually crush itself because climate change will do that to this economy. All our climate projections under the IPCC and our national work clearly show you have to change in order to have a thriving community. You can't just status quo won't work. But people know their jobs. They have their employers have figured out how to make this economy work. So that transition is a really challenging thing. And yet there are glimmers of hope. And we're seeing in the historic funding that we're doing, we're funding workforce. I'm now a workforce program manager, not an I'm just not education anymore. I'm education and workforce. And what's interesting about that is workforce, I think, has got a key for our future, because what we're doing is we're creating the jobs and the capacity to actually do the work of climate action. But the people who actually are doing it, the welder in Louisiana, they used to weld for offshore oil and gas. Now they're welding for offshore wind. They're still a welder. What they're welding, until they got that job on offshore wind, and the amount of contracts for welding for offshore wind, as far as the eye can see, you can't see the end of how much welding it is. But before they got that job, they thought climate change solutions was the end of their life, their inability to pay for their kids to go to college. Unfortunately, in the United States, parents have to pay for college. I know it's a surprise. I don't know why we do it, but we do. Once you have a job and the solution, and it's a good job, and you can actually build the momentum to dealing with climate change, because that challenge becomes an opportunity. And I think that the more we can pivot this work into the opportunity space, the opportunity to deal with the problem, the opportunity to be part of the solution, the opportunity to build better communities in this, and then the opportunity to do that together across communities, whether it's across the United States or between the European Union and the United States. I think I see a lot of possibility in the workforce focus that is new and important. So that's probably enough there. Hopefully that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It was really, really interesting. You're insisting a lot on capacity building and the need for collaboration, of course, and from knowing each other, which is what we're trying to do here. In one sentence, what would you say to our community members?
Let's get to know each other. Relationships are really important here. For the longest time, the European Union and the United States on this topic have not been talking with each other. There have been pieces of it. There's been parts, but I think we need to, if I've learned anything in my 18 years of doing this, we have to have relationships, because that's where sharing is, that's where learning is, that's where collaboration is, that's where we can find things that we didn't know. So we have to build relationships. And so, I think if the pandemic taught us anything, this right here works. It's not the same. It's not an antidote,
but it's something.
But it works. I've built relationships, video relationships that actually are working, trusted, effective relationships. So I think if I had to say one thing, is we just need to build more venues and places for collaboration. But before collaboration, you have relationship. And so we need to build relationships with each other so we can actually see where the possibilities are. And I would just invite all the listeners of this across the European Union that there is a depth of climate education in the United States that is not well known. And I don't mean this in a bragging way. I mean it as a substantial opportunity for sharing. Part of my motivation for doing this talk and also writing the national communications is to enhance collaboration, but also these people, if you have advanced work that you're doing in the European Union, they would love to learn. So we have ways of enhancing learning from each other and also sharing with each other. But I think that if we don't do that, we've missed a huge opportunity. And education plays a critical role in how society is going to advance its climate solutions.
Thank you.
Hopefully that helps.
Thank you so much, Frank. Looking forward to collaborating with you. Bye-bye.
Fantastic. Take care.